in the empire days of old, when they murdered for the gold and paraded it along the streets of London. Oh, no human rights were given to the natives, dead or living, Las Islas, Malvinas, Argentina.
This is, well, not quite Bristol, no, this is Burnham Overy Village Hall in North Norfolk. It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, welcome to the COVID Secure, not the BCFM Politics Show on Friday the 24th of September. We are streaming live from Burnham Overy Staithe, actually, out the back of the Village Hall, which is a beautiful primary school. Obviously, that's been moved somewhere, one of the other villages around here. And now it's just being used as a village hall, which is the reason I'm here, is, you know, this is the event really I think all the mainstream London news should be covering tonight, which is the annual general meeting of the Skulhead and District Common Rights Holders Association. Now, might not sound very exciting, but there's a real battle going on in North Norfolk, which is a continuation of something that's been going on for centuries around here, which is grabbing land, and the land grabs by the National Trust and the Royal West Norfolk Golf Club, amongst others, have been going on, particularly because the land around here has become so valuable. The common rights holders have got something like 4,500 acres of common land, two massive commons, which was originally set aside for the use of the poor of the villages back in the 1700s. And bit by bit, the National Trust and the Royal West Norfolk Golf Club have been grabbing this land, claiming it quietly. And the reason I'm here is because the fight has moved on to something around the parish council. Brancaster Parish Council is the only body that can lodge counterclaims at the land registry against the National Trust. As the National Trust claims land, hundreds of acres in some cases around here, it just puts in a claim at the land registry and said, this is ours, no one else is using it, which is not the case. The only people that can legally lodge the counterclaims are the parish council. And now these powerful, well-heeled forces around here, the trust and the interests of the Royal West Norfolk Golf Club, are starting to really infest the parish council and stop the parish council from lodging counterclaims, even though it's parish council land that the National Trust have been claiming. Anyway, fascinating, and we'll be hearing hopefully from one of the parish councillors here, who is also a common rights holder, a little bit later. We are also streaming live from radioquk.com, I hope, in Camberley, Surrey. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping me review this week's news is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. So tonight, government chief scientific advisor Chris Whitty, is he the UK's Dr. Mengele? Tonight we're looking at fluoride. This is Whitty's latest brilliant idea, but he wants to put neurotoxin called fluoride in all our water. And also there's a Rachel Elnell who we'll be hearing in part two. She is the Dragon's Den winner, but she's in trouble for doing a tweet saying Chris Whitty will hang. And as part of that, we're going to hear her take on the occasions of the lockdown announcements being made on interesting days, like the solstices and the equinoxes and the cross-quarter days, which is an interesting thing that she's observed. So there's also the Doctor of the Week from the Caribbean this time. Brilliant guy, about 15 minutes with him. It's Dr. Michael McDowell. He talks about the COVID as a bioweapon. And also, he takes us through the six smoking guns of SARS-CoV-2. Bill Gates, too, is looking forward, apparently, to the next pandemic. At least that's according to Gates. So we'll have a listen to what he's got to say. But first, a whole load of other stuff, of course, has been going on. Boris and Insulate Britain, the war on cars and the war on coal. They both seem to be working hand in hand. The fuel shortage that never was, this fuel shortage announced yesterday and all over the news today, is apparently due to no lorry drivers. Well, funnily enough, the oil companies, Esso and BP, make some of the greatest profits in the world of any business, and they are far bigger than many countries in terms of the turnover, annual turnover. Of course, they can afford to pay the very, very best wages to lorry drivers. And yet, I mean, I've been over in Peterborough and Northampton the last couple of days, which are major distribution hubs for the whole country, it being very central to the whole UK or England anyway. And there's loads of lorries around here, massive loads of one after another of IKEA lorries streaming out. Amazon lorries streaming all around the country, and yet we haven't got enough drivers to deliver petrol. Well, you know what happened last night? Prices of fuel went up across the country by about 5 pence a litre. Isn't that clever? So they've put out a scare so everyone goes to fill up. But just before they do it, like last night, literally, and I've looked at the prices of these petrol stations are changing from yesterday. This seems like a total scam to me. The fuel shortage that never was, just a price hike by the cartel and the misuse of a supine mass media that doesn't ask any questions about why they haven't got a driver. Also, Joy Warren, more on fluoride. She is going to talk to us in an exclusive interview about why fluoride is a poison and why it shouldn't go into our water. Christopher Bryson has done a documentary a few years ago. We're going to have a little excerpt from that. That's called The Fluoride Deception. He's also done a book on the topic too. And one of Martin's favourites, Tulsi Gabbard, on Afghanistan. And one of Martin's not-so-favourites, Boris, talking about the spat between France and the USA last weekend, certainly one of the things I'm looking at is that this could be the end of NATO. Afghanistan was a NATO project. That's fallen apart. And this deal between the French and the Australians has been scuppered by the Five Eyes countries. NATO seems to be falling to pieces. Labour conference just coming up this weekend. The Labour Equalities Women and Women's Secretary has resigned this week. Marsha de Cordova, pressure not to talk to those opposed to the new Gender Recognition Act. That's what's been pressure put on her by Keir Starmer to make sure that the new Gender Recognition Act, more support for self-identification in law, that Starmer doesn't want her talking to people who don't agree with that. And so she's resigned this week. Very little in the news about that. A chaotic meeting of the West of England Combined Authority, overseen by Dan Norris, the Labour Metro Mayor, and rising gas prices. I mean, it's kind of similar to the Esso and BP story we had earlier. And also, of course, universal credit, £1,000 a year about to be taken away from the poorest people in the country. There you go. Levelling up? No, levelling down. That's what Boris is up to. Anyway, Martin, let's start there, shall we, with this appalling decision to take £1,000 away from everybody in the country who are the poorest people.
Well, that's right. And it's also, everybody can see the unfairness of it, or most people can. But the other thing about it is the macroeconomics of it, because actually the economy is very fragile. And when the economy is fragile, you shouldn't be taking money out of people's pockets. This is exactly the mistake that Osborne made back in 2012, and the economy started to go down the drain. And as the economy starts to go down the drain, as it may do, then in actual fact, the budget deficit increases rather than decreases. And they did this exactly the same thing the Tories did previously, and they're doing it again. And of course, at the same time, they're trying to balance the books on the backs of the poorest people. No attempt whatsoever to claw back the money from who've been the big winners from the pandemic. But at the same time, it's also potentially, from a car driving point of view, you're slamming on the brake. And what may happen here is you're going to lose control of the vehicle.
There seems to be a lot of use of similes like that analogies, you know. But at the end of the day, surely people need this money to spend to keep the economy going.
That's right. And this is a big issue across the world, but it's certainly a big issue here. Once you get to the mess we're in now, you can't cut public expenditure. If you try, what you do is actually take demand out of the economy, which then slows the economy, which means the tax base, the taxes you'd run a draw in go down, and the economy just gets into a downward spiral. Now, as the Irish reputedly used to say, if I were you, I wouldn't start from here. But the fact is, that the Japanese have not been able to reduce public expenditure since the 1990s. And that's where we are. But at the same time, people are still living in the past where they think that they can reduce public expenditure. And the only way to balance the books in the medium to the long term is to raise taxes on wealth.
Yeah, and what's happening right now, though, is you've got over the last 2 months, tens of thousands of people being evicted because during the COVID, they were protected from eviction. Now they're actually being hoofed out. The county court's full up with people being thrown out of their homes.
That's right. And this winter is going to be incredibly tough for people on low incomes, cuts in universal credit, loss of housing, increases in national insurance payments, which is basically a tax on the working poor, and increases in gas and other prices, partly to do with mismanagement and partly, I dare I say it, Tony, to the labour shortages caused by Brexit.
Well, yeah, of course you can say that if you want, but really this would have happened without Brexit as well. I mean, I think we've got rising gas prices. This is another, this is like a double whammy for anybody who, you know, we talk years and years ago, and we do it regularly, don't we, about Mr. Micawber and this whole idea that if you've got just 5 pence more than you need, you're okay. But if you've got 5 pence less than you need a week, it's misery. And this is where the whole country, the lowest quartile of wealth are going. They're really kicking the poorest in the country by this free market in gas, which is now meaning that people are going to be having to pay something like 15-20% more for all their energy bills, literally just like that, maybe even more.
Yeah, well, I mean, the real problem here is the privatization of the energy sector in the 1980s and subsequently. I mean, in other countries, dare I say it, Russia, Gazprom is owned by the government. EDF Energy is owned by the French government. The Germans' energy sector is largely owned by local government. What we have here is a so-called free market with loads and loads of small suppliers who've now all gone bust. And that, of course, is going to happen in the care home sector and in other sectors where privatisation has taken place. Because in actual fact, these things are permanent issues that need to be dealt with on a planned basis. And the whole idea of the privatisation of the energy industry was supposedly to create a free market, but it just created an oligopoly, which then basically profiteered at the expense of the population. They then brought in more people to try and increase competition. And of course, you can't actually do that. All of these small operators are just going to be wiped out here, and we're going to be back to the big six, which is British Gas was owned by the government in the first place, just as it is in Norway.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, to see all this stuff happening this week with all these businesses saying, well, actually, we can't make any money anymore, so we're just going to fold up because of the price cap. We can't increase the price, so let's just fold the company and, you know, walk away. Now, interesting that the Mayor Marvin Rees in Bristol chose not to do that with Bristol Energy. Surely the idea should have been, as soon as it became clear that Bristol Energy couldn't make money, they should have just folded the business and walk away. But no, there's something like between 30 and £50 million of public money went down the drain with Bristol Energy. So, you know, but at the end of the day, with these gas prices, I've been scrying right across the world and across the internet. I can't find a single actual reason why this wholesale price has gone up, other than these massive energy companies now, which are, as you say, not connected to government, apart from things like Gazprom. They can just get together as a cartel and say, right, everybody, the price is going up this week.
Well, that's what they used to do. I think there are objective reasons for this. I mean, one of the things that made me laugh this week is reading in, I think it was Business Insider, about the evil Russians who are trying to force the price of gas up. And these are exactly the same kind of people who are crying foul about the Nord Stream 2 pipeline.
Well, Martin,
and the Russians have basically put Nord Stream 2 online, which is there to actually
provide the West with gas. I mean, as Nord Stream 2 comes online, surely it makes sense to say, right, we want this the initial prices to be very high, and that's a good price to start with. It's a high price, and then maybe they'll bring the prices down a bit. But the Russians are trying to get a good initial high price for the Nord Stream 2 gas.
Well, I mean, there is a kind of a market in gas, because, you know, you've got Qatar shipping gas all around the world, and the Americans, the US, attempting to do so. But ultimately, things like gas, the prices are ultimately determined by very long-term investment decisions, like the building of pipelines, which is why it's a classic industry that should be in the public sector, 100%.
Yeah,
just like the Norwegian oil industry.
Well, I totally agree with you. But the thing is, I mean, what I find so difficult to stomach about this, I mean, it's been dominating the news all week. I haven't heard a single journalist questioning it, is it's the middle of summer. You know, the demand for gas is absolutely minimum. Whether it's power stations or people's domestic homes, the demand for gas is minimal right now. It's in 6 months' time, it's going to be probably at least twice as much. But now is where the price hike is taking place.
Well, that's right. And of course, it's not the sort of thing that people can not buy. So there's a very strong price inelasticity. People have to have a certain amount of gas.
Well, yeah, but you can turn your gas heating down or whatever. You know, this time of year, you can turn the gas heating down, can't you? Whereas in the middle of winter, you haven't got an option.
Yeah, but in the winter, as you say, you can't. And that means, of course, that people are going to have to spend more on it, which means that they won't be able to manage on the money that they're on, which means they're going to go to food banks to get food. And this has been going on for a very long time, and it's going to intensify as we go forward. And all of the hot air and promises from the Tory government about levelling up are shown for what they actually are. This is basically a squeeze on the people with the lowest incomes. For example, the national insurance increase in order to help wealthy homeowners in the southeast of England not to lose their nest eggs. Couldn't be clearer. This is class war. That's what it is.
Well, yes. The only people apparently who can do anything about this are the Keir Starmer Labour Party. The only trouble is they're having their conference. I don't know if you're going, Martin, or going to be following the weekend.
I'm not going to the conference.
Labour Equalities and Women's Secretary has resigned this week, Marcia de Cordova. This is one of the keynote policies of Starmer, is he wants to have more support for self-identification with the pressure group Stonewall and the Labour LGBT rights groups, putting a lot of pressure on with Starmer on her to support a big extension of rights of people to self-identify, for example, for men to self-identify as women and then to use ladies' toilets, which is something that apparently Starmer thinks is okay, whereas a lot of women actually don't want that, Martin.
Well, there's a very bad-tempered debate developing around this topic, there's going to be different views about it. And there ought to be a bit more common sense about arguing about it without turning, you know, people who disagree with your views on this, whatever they are not evil people. There's just a difference of perspective. If I can put it this way, if we were to say that white people could self-identify as black, would that be legitimate? Could you say, I self-identify as black, so I want to be part of a black only organisation? And I think we'd all be pretty much clear that that wouldn't be acceptable. So
no, you're right.
You know,
well,
that
you're
probably
right.
Gives
well,
you I mean, a clue about where my thinking lies.
Well, what if a bunch of people turned up dressed as the black and white minstrels and said, "I want to be part of Black Lives Matter"? I mean, it would be making fun of them.
Indeed, but that doesn't mean that there aren't issues about discrimination against trans people. There certainly are, and people who identify trans or want to change their sexual identification, there shouldn't be a problem with that. But that can't turn into assuming that you can just talk your way into other organizations, for example, which are women only, because they've got a right to say, well, we don't basically accept you as a woman, we accept you as a trans person, why not? But you can't just say that you're going to be able to use women's toilets, for example. Now, I understand that there's a debate about this, and I'm open to discussion about it. But you can see it's causing problems. It's causing problems in Scotland as well. And it's causing problems in lots of these issues are, you know, convoluted. But of course, we've just been discussing screwing the poor out of the little that they have. And that, of course, really is what the Labour movement should be focusing on.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. I mean, in a way, this is just a great big distraction, isn't it? But just to let people know, have your pens ready because, or your, I don't know, if you can do it on a computer, bookmarking things, because there's an enormous amount of resistance to the way that Starmer is trying to steer the Labour Party agenda post-Corbyn amongst the Labour left. And they're starting to get, as more and more of them get expelled, punished, suspended, they're starting to get very organised, and there is a website where which is called The Resist Event. That is The Resist Event, one word, .com, which is doing all sorts of sessions this weekend and into next week about these kinds of matters and where the Labour Party is heading in this. Many of people are Labour Party members, but are critical of the right wing direction that Keir Starmer has been trying to take the Labour Party, and so that is theresistevent.com. I mean, I can't go through this, about 20 different speakers, 20 different panels, events. Some of it is face-to-face, some of it is Zoom meetings, which anyone can watch, listen in on. But there is an enormous kind of, almost like, Martin, this is the point, isn't it? A counter-conference going on this year.
Yeah, I believe Bernie Sanders is coming over to speak to this, you know, fringe conference, if you like.
It's a counter conference. What they're saying effectively is that the Labour Party is not allowing a whole load of debate on a whole load of important left wing issues. And it's a bit like the old, I'm sure you remember when the IMF used to meet up and the big wigs from around the world, there would be an alternative conference organised. The G7. They would have an alternative conference. I'm not sure what it was called, but it was a terrific gathering of people from around the world. So the same sort of thing is going on with the Labour Party this weekend.
Yeah, except that people will be delegates to both. You know, when I used to be involved in organising the other economic summits, and, you know, we were not.
Oh, that's right. It was called Toad,
summits,
wasn't it?
Whereas people who are going to this alternative summit, some of them will be delegates to the mainstream conference. It's a bit more like the Edinburgh Fringe. So it's part of the conference and not part of the conference.
It used to be called TOES, didn't it? TOES, the Other Economic Summit. Brilliant idea. Anyway, look, we're going to go to Boris Johnson now to our first clip, only quite a short one. But here's Boris talking this week about how the British started climate change, and so we must show the whole world the way out.
We're the guys who created the problem. And, you know, the Industrial Revolution started in more or less in our country, in the iron and coal fields of the Midlands and elsewhere. That's where it began. And since then, for 250 years or more, we've been pumping this stuff out. And so, of course, I understand the feelings of injustice in the developing world, and the passionate appeals we just heard from Costa Rica, the Maldives, and other countries just now. But I say to them is, yes, that's why we've got to get the funding to help you to make the progress that you need, and that's why the $100 billion is so important. And if Beth is right, then let's hope there's progress. We'll watch it very carefully. But the second thing is that you can do it. You can transit away from coal, and the UK itself, I think, in 2012, 40% of our power came from coal. It's now less than 1%. When I was a kid, it was 70%. And that's partly because of gas, but it's mainly because of the arrival of clean, green renewables on a scale that we never dreamt possible. And it's bringing that imagination to bear on the problem that I think will make all the difference.
So that's Boris Johnson there. Martin, this whole idea that the British started climate change with the Industrial Revolution, so it's our job to show the world the way out. Does that make sense to you?
Well, I mean, the argument is that the developed countries, including Britain, the United States, and other European countries, they have generated historically the highest levels of CO2, and other developing countries need to develop. You know, they are poorer than we are, partly because of imperialism, which wasn't a word that Boris Johnson used. And therefore, if they are going to make sacrifices to reduce CO2 emissions, they need to be compensated. Now, of course, this is a very big issue, because it's not just CO2 emissions that they need to be compensated for if we're going to actually address the injustices of the past. And ultimately, of course, this is not very likely in the current world setup, where the Chinese Communist Party or the Communist Party of China would have to be a major player in all of this, and there'd have to be major transfers from wealthy people in countries like Britain to the Chinese Communist Party run China in order to balance this out. That ain't going to happen. Probably there isn't going to be a deal. And ultimately, there's going to be a showdown between the poor and the rich. And of course, the rich must lose.
Well, no, they won't, though, will they? Because they've got all the big guns.
Not necessarily, Tony. They're not necessarily going to win, because the rest of the world is waking up to the way they've been treated over the last 200 years. And they're getting their feet at last. And the people that have dominated the planet, the Great Reset people, there ain't going to be a Great Reset. There's going to be something else, and it ain't going to be run by the powerful.
Yeah, the Great Reset was supposed to be announced, and everything was supposed to be agreed. I mean, this is one of the things I've noticed that the elite do now, is that they announce something big that's about to happen. They try and cajole all the various players to agree to it, and nobody wants to do it, and so it's then dropped and forgotten about.
Well, that's probably what will happen, which is why the hysteria about the Great Reset is slightly overdone. It's basically a wish list by the wealthy. And basically, they're going to run up against people like Xi Jinping saying, we're not doing that, we're not doing that, we're not doing that. And none of it will happen. And that,
but also,
ultimately,
yeah, the civil service too, I'd imagine. I mean, you know, there's basic things like the civil service. I'm thinking also about things like HS2 and Hinckley C. It just doesn't make any financial sense, either of them.
Well, I mean, you could argue that, you know, that there's a kind of institutional inertia that keeps the money flowing. I mean, HS2 now isn't going to go beyond Birmingham, which, in other words, it's of no use whatsoever to anywhere north of Birmingham. And of course, the money being spent has been spent into the economy, and some people, the contractors and so on, have made an awful lot of profit out of it. And that's the way in which failing late capitalism operates. It uses public resources to stuff the pockets of private investors for projects which are never completed. But of course, they serve the purpose of enriching the elite that makes the decisions.
Yeah, so we're going to move on now to look at fluoride this week. I think the big subject of the week. It was great. I was researching this earlier in the week, prompted by one of our listeners. And it turns out, yes, the government is doing all sorts of things to try and introduce fluoridation of water. This is something that the public have been fighting, and scientists, for many years. The only thing is, we've got the Voldemort Gollum love child, Chris Whitty, is championing this. He thinks it's great to use a neurotoxin in everyone's water because it's proven to have lowered the IQ of kids, you know, from a controlled subject for many years. And I've looked around to find some good documentation on fluoride, and it's the best documents I can find. And the easiest to digest, quite short actually, is something called the Professional Statement to End Fluoridation. And this is from Canada back 3-4 years ago, actually, in 2018, November. So the first statement, there was one in 2007, and then there was another statement, because this was so successful, it went around the world and was copied and used by anti-fluoride campaigners all over the world. So it was that many thousands of scientists, all sorts of different scientists, actually, over in Canada, signed this action, a statement to end fluoridation. 8 recent events, they say, make action to end water fluoridation urgent. So they're not talking about not starting it. They're saying any places in the US and Canada which fluoridate their water must stop. He's saying the publication in 2006 of a 500-page review of fluoride's toxicology by a panel appointed by the National Research Council of the National Academies, NRC 2006, concluded the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's safe drinking water standards for fluoride, or 4 parts per million, is unsafe and must be lowered. Despite over 60 years of fluoridation, the report listed many basic research questions that haven't been addressed. Still, the panel reviewed a large body of literature which fluoride has a statistically significant association with a wide range of adverse effects. Increased risk of bone fractures, decreased thyroid function, lowered IQ, arthritic-like conditions, dental fluorosis, and osteosarcoma, whatever that is, sarcoma. Now, The average fluoride daily intakes associated with many of these adverse effects are reached by some people consuming water at the concentration levels now used for fluoridation, especially small children. And I'm going to go through the you know, a little sort of one sentence of each of these points. And that was the first one. The second one is the evidence provided by U.S. Centers of Disease Control. 32% of American children have dental fluorosis, an abnormal discoloration and mottling of the enamel. Now, hang on a minute. This is already being shown that the kids are getting fluorosis, 32% of American kids, since they started fluoridating the water. That's point number two. Point number three, the American Dental Association's policy change in 2006 recommended only the following types of water be used for preparing infant formula during the first 12 months of life: purified, distilled, deionized, demineralized, or produced through reverse osmosis. So what they're saying is, American Dental Association themselves are saying, whatever you do, don't use tap water for the 12 months of life, because it's got fluoride in it, which is toxic to your child's development. So that's number three. Number four, the CDC conceded in 1999 and 2001, predominant benefit in fluoride in reducing tooth decay is topical and not systemic. In other words, it's okay to put a bit of fluoride actually on your teeth, but the idea that it should actually go into your system is ridiculous. It doesn't help. In fact, it's a toxin. It shouldn't go inside. By all means, put a little bit of on your tooth, and that might help, but not in your body. So that's point number four. Point number five, in 2000, the British government sponsored something called the York Review, the first systematic scientific review of fluoridation, found none of the studies purporting to demonstrate the effectiveness of fluoridation to reduce tooth decay were of any grade A status, that is to say, high quality, and the bias is likely in those. So that's point five. Point six, the publication in May 2006 of a peer-reviewed case control study from Harvard found that 5 to 7-fold increase in osteosarcoma, a frequently fatal bone cancer in young men, associated with exposure to fluoride. 5 to 7-fold increase. What the hell are you up to, Witty, putting this stuff in our water, and particularly for the young, most vulnerable children? It's funny, because you're doing something quite rather similar for children, trying to encourage them to have a vaccine, which they don't need, and which is an experimental vaccine. Point seven in their list from Canada is the admission by federal agencies in response to questions from a congressional subcommittee that industrial-grade waste products used to fluoridate over 90% of America's drinking water supplies have never been subjected to toxicological testing. And this is the rub, isn't it? That actually, this is a way of the chemical industry getting rid of toxic waste, sticking it in our water. Unbelievable, but true. The publication, point number eight, the final point, in 2004, of the Fluoride Deception by Christopher Bryson, meticulously researched book, showed that industrial interests concerned about liabilities from fluoride pollution and health effects on workers have played a big role in the early promotion of fluoridation. Bryson also details the harassment of scientists who express concern safety about the safety and efficacy of fluoridation. So it's a pretty comprehensive report, this. I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk from these Canadians. Their website is fluoridealert.org, fluoridealert, fluoridealert.org. And we're going to hear first from, we've got a couple of interviews. One is with a local campaigner here in the UK. Her name's Joy Warren. And I spoke to her earlier this week, where she explained to me that actually, hey guys, fluoride is a poison, and the government shouldn't be putting this into our drinking water, which it's now trying to do all over the country.
400 research studies worldwide in the last 30 years, all pointing to a reduction in a child's intelligence. That's the worst thing that could happen to any parent, have a child whose intelligence has been damaged by what they've been eating. And of course, it's not just the toothpaste, it's the fluoridated water. And it's encountered when the child is in the womb, because mother's drinking fluoridated water, she's eating fluoridated foods, and she's also probably drinking tea. And tea has a lot of fluoride in it, because that's what's in the soil on which the tea plant grows in India and Kenya, Tanganyika.
Okay, so what is fluoride actually doing to you when it goes into your body?
because it's extremely electronegative, it disrupts so many processes. We're not dead, of course, because we're not having too much. But if we have certain sensitivities, it'll probably target that particular part of our body, which is weakest. And it's we know that it destroys enzymes. And we certainly know that it's antagonistic to iodide in the thyroid gland and the rest of the endocrine system. And that's the worst thing, of course, because children who are challenged when very young by fluoride have their endocrine systems messed about, especially if they're low on iodide.
So, well, how do they know? What's this iodide stuff?
Well, iodide is the essential mineral required for efficient endocrine thyroid function. But because of the law of halogens, fluoride displaces larger atoms in the halogen family. Bromide, chloride, and iodide. And so basically, fluoride, because it's the tiniest atom of a four, displaces all other three in the body. And that's bad news for the body, because those three, especially the chlorides and the iodide, are required for essential body systems.
Okay, so the reason we're having a chat is because the government is doing in Britain is trying to get more fluoride in our water. So what stage are we at the moment? Because I know there's been a battle over the decades to keep fluoride out of British water. And to what extent is it being added?
At the moment, we're still no more than 6 million people, and that's 10% of England, which it's been like that since 1985, how does anybody know
if they're getting fluoride in their water?
Because you look on water companies' websites and you look for the water quality reports for your postcode, and then you can have a look and see if you've got fluoride. If you've got fluoride at less than 1 milligram, it may be that you are fluoridated. Sometimes they dilute the water to eke out supplies. But if you've got something like 0.4 milligram, that's natural fluoride. It means you're not artificially fluoridated.
Is there any simple way, sort of a map or whatever, to tell, you know, whether your part of the country's got fluoride or not?
Absolutely. Yes, there is. And you can get it from the British Fluoridation Society. And it's got patches of artificially fluoridated areas and patches of naturally fluoridated areas on it. It is a patchwork, but it hasn't advanced anywhere because of people like me, and more specifically, people in the National Pure Water Association, who did sterling work in the 80s, 90s and early 2000s. Yes, we've been battling. I mean, personally, I have been battling against fluoridation in Bedford's borough, central Bedfordshire, Hull, the northeast, that's Durham County, Northumbria, Sunderland and South Tyneside. And we're now actually having a bit of a ding-dong battle in West Cumbria. But the ones I've actually been involved with, we've won them all, although we never get the credit for it, because they just, you know, we're not told why we didn't lose. We're not told why they didn't decide to go for fluoridation, because that would be tantamount to criticising their Public Health England employees.
Well, isn't that interesting? Isn't it? I find it absolutely fascinating that the authorities seem to want to do this unless people are awake, you know, like yourself, and trying to stop it somewhere. But they, of course, will be arguing, look, we're doing this from a public health point of view, and I'm sure they must have strong arguments. So what do you think is the real agenda? If this is actually bad for public health, why is this, pressure groups, MPs, Lords, etc., trying to force this down our throat?
Yes, I think it's something to do with the dental profession. The British Dental Association is very much in favour, and the British Fluoridation Society are their pals. We know at the moment there are quite a few dentists who've gone out of business because of COVID. Some are retiring early and some are retiring anyway, which means that there are not so many clinical placements for dental school students. so they can't complete their courses. That has a knock-on effect. They can't have as many placements in the dental schools because there's nowhere to put them when they're halfway through their course, which means there's going to be a reduction in the number of dentists in the next few years. So as a palliative, if you like, they think that perhaps they should fluoridate everybody. That means that they won't get so much decay. But unfortunately, that is, how can I say, smokescreen and mirrors situation, because fluoride added to drinking water does not really appreciably reduce dental decay. There's a huge survey in America in 1998, I think, 39,000 young people were looked at and their fluoridation status was compared with their dental health. And they found that when they crunched the numbers, only 0.6 of the surface of a tooth had been saved because of the child's fluoridation status. So well, it's not very good.
Well, it's easy for you to say this, but, you know, and also very easy to say things like, oh, well, it slows down children's educational abilities. Is there any actual proof for that, though?
Well, this is 400 research studies throughout the world, starting off in China and then Iran, Mexico. And then now we've got these Canadian studies, which are really robust. And they followed mother-child pairings to see and what happened to their intelligence. We know that the intelligence of the unborn child is affected and the intelligence of the infant fed on fluoridated formula is affected. And they've worked out that for the level of fluoride added to drinking water in Canada, for example, which is 0.7 milligrams per litre of water, the intelligence reduces by 5 to 6 IQ points.
I wonder, water was privatised by Margaret Thatcher in the 1980s. Do you think that's made any difference to the way that this has gone?
Margaret Thatcher had a hand in legalising fluoridation in 1985, following a Scottish court decision where the judge, Lord Jauncey, said, "It's fluoridated water is a medicine. Full stop, it's a medicine." And that really panicked the Conservative government of the day. And Alan Clark and Margaret Thatcher got together and said, "Look, we're going to have to do something about this." And at that time, fluoride had been practiced in England for 30 years. 1955 was the first trial or demonstration of fluoride in drinking water when nobody was asked if they wanted to drink it. And for 30 years after that, no one was asked at all because the health authorities were saying, "Yeah, you know, we're going to do it." And they just did it because they owned the water utilities at the time. So they could just draw a contract between themselves, as it were. So in 1985, the Conservative government panicked and said, "Look, you know, we've got to regularise the situation. For 30 years, it hasn't been enshrined in law. It's just a practice which has crept in and we think we'd better legalise it." So they did. Now, the vote in Parliament, it was supposed to be an open vote, but we think it was a 3-line whip. The final vote was something like 80 against legalising fluoridation, 160 in favour of legalising fluoridation, and 400 abstentions. And most of the country has proper treated water with nothing added apart from chlorine. But in the fluoridated areas, we then have a soup of acid added, which then converts it into a medicine. Therefore, it's not drinking water. Now, the smoke screen and mirrors thing here again is that it's a neat trick. Government and the MHRA, or the Medicines Healthcare Regulatory Products Agency, which award licenses for medicines, they do not admit to it being a medicine, even though it's clearly stated in the British standard, which controls the quality of the fluoridating acid, that it is added to increase the resistance of consumers to dental decay. So it's got to be a medicine. And in fact, when you look at the drinking water directive, medicinal waters are not drinking waters. So in two counts, fluoridated water is definitely not drinking water. It's very important to have that point because drinking water's quality standards have a certain amount maximum of all the different chemicals that can occur in raw water before it's treated, and obviously when the fluoridating acid is added. But in this case, if there's no, if it's not drinking water, we're not protected by the drinking water quality standards. So any amount of contaminants is too much. Now, the trick is to try and get the governments and the MHRA and the NHS to accept that the stuff is added in order to treat humans. And that's such a bad thing because we haven't given our consent ever and we've never been asked.
So that's Joy Warren there, speaking to me earlier this week from West Midlands Against Fluoridation. Also, she mentioned a fascinating little organisation. I'm not sure quite how strong they are now, but they were involved in 20 years ago or so fighting the fluoridation. They're called the National Pure Water Association. And one can't help but wonder that the water industry has been keeping its powder dry for a few years, waiting until these other organisations, you know, people die and they become unnecessary. They think, oh, we've got, we don't face a threat from fluoridation, until they've now started more recently. Anyway, so before we hear from Martin, we're going to hear another clip about fluoridation from the documentary that I mentioned earlier. So that is called The Fluoride Deception. And actually, it's a very good documentary, really an interview with Christopher Bryson, who wrote this book, The Fluoride Deception. And here he is, one of the key bits of the longer interview that was done with him as part of this documentary.
Fluoride defenders will say there's two stories. There's the industrial story and there's the dental story, and ne'er the twain shall meet. It's not true. The stories are braided very tightly and very profoundly, and they're braided from the beginning. The very first suggestion that fluoride be added to public water supplies was made by a researcher, Gerald Cox, at the Mellon Institute in Pittsburgh. Cox became interested in fluoride because of the suggestion of Francis Frary. That's the letter I uncovered. Francis Frary is the director of the aluminum laboratory for the Aluminum Company of America. He is very concerned about fluoride pollution around aluminum plants. He's very concerned about what the fluoride is doing to the workers inside these aluminum plants. But his suggestion to Gerald Cox is to look at fluoride's dental effects. And it's upon the basis of that suggestion that Gerald Cox makes his proposal to add fluoride to public water supplies. Right at the very source of the stream, you find the aluminum industry. Cox's suggestion that we add fluoride to public water supplies needs to be understood for who was saying it and where he was saying it and what the track record of the Mellon Institute was. The Mellon Institute was a leading defender of asbestos for the asbestos industry. You know, today, industry are facing a tidal wave, a crippling tidal wave of lawsuits from people who have been, had their health damaged, who've been killed by asbestos. Well, for generations, the Mellon Institute produced research that said that mesothelioma was caused by something other than asbestos. That's how you have to understand the fluoride issue. Industry was concerned about fluoride pollution and about lawsuits of a similar magnitude for fluoride pollution. So it's no coincidence that the Mellon Institute makes the first suggestion that fluoride be added to public water supplies. The selling of fluoride to the American public was done by the best in the business, by the father of public relations, Edward Bernays. Edward Bernays is Sigmund Freud's nephew, and he was a Machiavellian genius, small in size, yet cast a towering shadow over the 20th century. Bernays understood that there was a liberal sentiment coursing through the 20th century, and that if you could hitch your commercial wagon to that star, then you could make your clients a lot of money. In 1916, Bernays had suffragettes march in the Easter parade in New York City holding cigarettes as torches of liberty. And he cooked up that scheme on behalf of the American Tobacco Company and its director, George Hill, who was paying Bernays's salary. Well, my book uncovers correspondence between Bernays and the National Institutes of Dental Research. Bernays was asked to come to Washington by the NIDR to help create their PR campaign to sell fluoride to the nation. Bernays understood that people have an unconscious trust in their doctor or their dentist, and if you can persuade doctors and dentists that fluoride is safe and good, then you're able to reach the rest of the nation. People believe their doctors and dentists, and that was a way of promoting fluoride for Bernays. Very few dentists are aware that the fluoride in public water supplies is not a pharmaceutical-grade product. It is, in fact, an industrial waste. It's the waste from the Florida phosphate industry. In the 1950s, the Florida phosphate industry was being sued by farmers and citizens living near those plants because of the fluoride was killing their cattle, destroying their crops. You know, the Florida phosphate industry today is prevented from having to dispose of its industrial effluent in a toxic waste dump by the device of shipping that in tanker trucks around the country and dumping it in our water supply.
Well, that's pretty shocking, isn't it? This is the Florida phosphate industry. Actually, I think it's this fertilizer industry. Obviously, phosphate is used for all sorts of other things, but that was the voice there of Christopher Bryson, whose brilliant book, The Fluoride Deception, really should have nailed this once and for all. And yet, Martin, this Conservative government is pursuing this apace. They want everyone to have fluoride in their water, and it's a neurotoxin.
Well, it's interesting to hear the various contributions there, but I don't really have any, you know, technical knowledge to add to what's been said. But what I would say is it's clearly becoming the case that dental care is becoming a luxury for wealthy people. And we are moving back to a situation before the welfare state in this country where poor people do not get dental care. And of course, dental care is actually quite important. If you look at stuff from the previous centuries, teeth malfunction in later life is fatal. You know, it leads to all sorts of problems. And it's really shocking that we've got a situation now with the NHS dental care basically on its last legs and everything privatised and many people having no access to dental care whatsoever.
Well, it's not just the dental care of the National Health Service, which is under threat.
No, it's not. But I mean, the dental care is treated as it always was semi-detached from the health service. So the dentists were always independent traders.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems that the whole principle of public health care in Britain is under the knife right now itself. But anyway, I'll put a link up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk to the excellent interview with Christopher Bryson. And I think, Martin, you know what he does there, particularly by bringing in the spooky character of Edward Bernays and the PR industry, is he's showing here is an industry with a toxic byproduct that they have to pay to dispose of. And they're trying to say, well, actually, let's see if we can't get this accepted as something which is a health benefit. And then we don't have to pay to dispose of it.
Well, I mean, you know, I haven't done the research that they have done, but, you know, it doesn't sound at all implausible, does it?
No. Anyway, let's move forward now to have a look at some of the international stories. And the biggie this week has got to be this deal, Martin, that was done, announced by Boris Johnson and obviously by Joe Biden with the Australians to sell them nuclear submarines. What do you make of this and the fallout that there was last weekend? We had a big announcement, didn't we, by the United States about the drone strike in Afghanistan back at the end of August. And that drone strike killed lots of innocent people. So my take on that was that the Americans normally would not make it a big announcement like that. Hey, guys, we killed loads of innocent people. They just don't do it. They don't really like to talk about their drone assassination program, particularly when it's mostly actually over the years has been killing innocent people rather than fighters, combatants or freedom fighters sometimes, you know. But this is an interesting timing. In the, of course, the French part of NATO, they would almost certainly have known all the details about this attack by the Americans on these innocent people in Kabul. And possibly, Martin, the Americans were making this announcement last Saturday night, I think it was, in order to make sure the French didn't beat them to it, to humiliate them in this diplomatic row that's going on.
Well, I think this deal on the submarines has been cooked up for some while. So I don't think it's directly related to the Kabul drone strike. The only thing that was different about the Kabul drone strike, of course, from all the other drone strikes in Afghanistan, is that it took place in Kabul, where the international media were able to find out pretty quickly that it was just ordinary people, including children.
Okay. But of course, a lot of these. Let me just pick you up on one thing you're saying there about the submarine deal, because it sounds to me as if you're implying that the French are making a big fuss about nothing here.
Well, no. I was just commenting on the subplot of the drone strike. Because, of course, these drone strikes have been going on for years. That particular one was actually reported, and therefore they couldn't get out of admitting what had happened.
Yeah, the French ambassador was withdrawn from Washington. There's been very, very strong comments from...
Yes, I mean, that's the submarine.
Both the Germans and the French about this, saying basically what you're doing is you're sticking twos up to NATO.
Yeah, well, what's going on here is very significant in some respects. The actual deal... is a bit of a curate's egg, because they're not going to get any nuclear submarines for at least a decade. So, and it's not clear how they're going to be paid for or anything. It's just really a sort of rabbit out of a hat in some respects. And the French are annoyed because they had a long-term deal with the Australians to supply them with non-nuclear submarines, which have been, you know, and basically the Australians have been saying to the French right up to the last minute, yes, the deal's on, nothing to worry about, and they didn't bother to inform them. They found out through the media that this whole deal that they've had with the Australians going back for years, and they, you know, they were basically preparing to produce all these submarines for them, and then the Australians knew that they were doing this deal with the Americans and the British, but they didn't bother to tell the French what was going on, and that's why they're particularly angry. And of course, there's also been anger in Western capitals, apart from the US, about what happened in Afghanistan, not least because there was no consultation about what the Americans were doing. They just said, we're going to do this, and everybody else is just going to have to...
But I mean, isn't that been the reality really since World War II, Martin, with NATO? Surely that, you know, the NATO countries just have to do what they're told by the Americans.
Well, that is pretty much how it is. But of course, there's a pretense that it is otherwise, and that other people, you know, that other NATO members are consulted, etc. It's never been true.
Well, that, but of that course, pretense when, is surely when, out when, the when window now.
We've now got to the point where the pretense that there's consultation, you know, there isn't even the pretense of consultation.
No, that's
the French
right.
simply were blindsided, and nobody bothered to tell them what was going on.
Okay, well, let's have a listen now
to... quite annoying.
Anyway, Afghanistan, a major, I mean, it's been in the news rather too much, I think, personally, but, you know, it is big. It is the end of the NATO. I mean, we on our 911forum.org.uk have got a long running thread on there, which has got all sorts of interesting stuff over the last decade or so, more than that, 15 years probably, saying, will Afghanistan break NATO? Well, it looks like maybe it has. Let's hear what Tulsi Gabbard, just tell us a little bit about her, because I know you, I do, when I see her saying interesting stuff, I always try and get clips with her, because I know you think she's a contender.
Well, she's not so much of a contender now at the moment. I mean, she was basically a congresswoman.
Maybe for the future. Yeah.
She was a congresswoman elected for the Democrats in Hawaii, and she's basically of Hindu origin, and you know, presumably of you know, people who came from India to Hawaii, and she is also a medic, a doctor, I think, or a nurse, and also an Iraq veteran. So she served in Iraq. She's a colonel. In the US Armed Forces or retired.
Okay, so anyway, let's have a listen.
She's also very strongly anti-war. And yeah. She was, as
most soldiers are, actually.
I think
Martin, I'm sorry. I think actually soldiers probably understand the dangers and the pitfalls and the horrors of war.
The Australian SAS are definitely on the on in the dock for killing loads and loads and loads of innocent.
Yeah, but this is the SAS. This is not your ordinary soldiers.
Well, they're soldiers
is it?
Too, Tony. So not all soldiers are like.
And I think I would suggest that, you know, there's loads and loads for now, for example, of young teenage boys, particularly who've been brought up on video games and think war's great, exciting. Wow, man, this is brilliant. Whereas actually,
and
people have to fight
soldiers,
and die. These
many of them.
People who fight and die in these wars often have a more realistic attitude.
Well,
anyway,
Tulsi Gabbard, certainly.
Yeah, anyway, let's have a listen now to Tulsi talking about Afghanistan earlier this week.
I think it's important for the American people to understand that Islamist jihadists are continuing to wage war against us. And the Islamist ideology, not the same as the religion of Islam, but this Islamist ideology, which is a political ideology that inspired the terrorist attacks on our country on 9/11, is the greatest threat that we're facing right now in this country and the world. It is the foundation of governance of so-called Islamic countries like Turkey and Iran and Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. And it's what's behind the discriminatory policies that they have in these countries against Christians, Hindus, Buddhists, atheists, and others. So as long as these Islamist jihadists are waging war against us, we have to work to defeat them militarily and ideologically. And militarily, we have two choices in how we do that. Number one, we can continue to invade and occupy and nation build in countries around the world, just as we did in Afghanistan at great cost. Number two, we can take a targeted approach using airstrikes, using our special forces to go in and go after these terrorist cells. The reality is that the cost to the American people, the cost to our troops, the cost to civilians will be far less if we take this very targeted approach to go after these jihadist terrorist cells than if we continue making the very same mistakes that we saw in Afghanistan and other parts of the world of invasion, occupation, and nation building.
So well, that's Tulsi Gabbard there, Democratic senator. She was a contender at one point for
she was a congresswoman. She's not even a congresswoman now.
Oh, right. Anyway, she's a contender anyway for the Democratic nomination for president a couple of years ago. Anyway, what would you make of what she had to say there?
I think what she's doing, I think she's thinking of having another run for president. And what she's doing there, I don't entirely agree with, because what she's trying to do is present herself as against Islamist extremism, and it's more sensible to have targeted strikes than invasions of other countries. Now, there's a case to be made for that, and I would say, yes, she's probably right, but she's missing the point that Islamist extremists in Syria have been armed and trained by her own military. And the simplest way to stop them attacking the Syrian army is to stop supplying them with weaponry. And of course, there's a delusion in the US that they have not been involved in Islamist terrorism. Whereas we know, going back to Afghanistan in the 1980s, that Western military, including the ones that Tulsi Gabbard was a member of, are intimately connected, for example, with the Saudi military, who are presently killing Muslims, Shia Muslims mostly, in Yemen. And British military personnel are also working closely with Saudi military personnel on this genocidal project. So the idea that there's a better way to fight Islamist extremism, the best way to fight Islamist extremism is to stop supporting it and accept that you have been supporting it. And that is where she's not going there, because that is not acceptable talk in the mainstream.
Well,
yeah,
you may be right. She might well be going for, I mean,
what she's doing there is trying to carve out a space for herself as an expert on this and hard on Islamist terrorism. The truth
you know
is,
what, Martin,
the US is not
Martin,
hard on Islamist terrorism. But
you know what she might be doing? She might be trying to carve herself out of space, and she doesn't even necessarily believe in what she's saying, but she knows that you have to say this stuff if you want to get the nomination. Anyway, it'd be interesting to see if it's her versus Trump next time. Who knows? You heard it here first, folks, if that happens, but maybe it won't. Anyway, Boris Johnson has been over in the United States making a buffoon of himself, but saying some quite funny stuff. I mean, his PR people are great and much better than, I mean, this is one of the reasons that Chris Morris and Mark Thomas and people like that are no longer on the television, is because the comedy writers are only allowed to write for our political leaders in order to try and give them a bit of credibility. That's how desperate things are. But anyway, Boris was saying things like "prenez-vous break" to the French. But here he is speaking in the United States debates earlier this week about this spat between French and the British and the French and the Americans.
Our relationship with France is incredibly important. It is historic. It goes back a long, long time. And it is founded on shared values, a shared belief in democracy. We work together around the world. The UK and France are shoulder to shoulder in the Sahel. Fighting terrorism in the Sahel. We're shoulder to shoulder in the Baltic states, in NATO's largest current mission. And it's an extraordinary fact. There is one other country in the world with whom we share a program to do simulated nuclear testing. Which country is that? It's France. The UK and France have, I believe, a very, very important and indestructible relationship. And of course, we'll be talking to all our friends about how to make the AUKUS pact work so that it's not exclusionary, it's not divisive, and it really doesn't have to be that way. This is just a way of the UK, the US, and Australia sharing certain technologies because that is the sensible thing to do in the world in which we find ourselves. But that does not in any way mean that we wish to be adversarial towards anybody else or exclusive or crowding anybody else out.
Well, he seems to be doing his best to destruct this so-called indestructible relationship with the French, Martin.
Well, he didn't mention that we were shoulder to shoulder with the French in the destruction of Libya, Operation Southern Mistral 2012, when Sarkozy and Cameron knocked down Colonel Gaddafi and opened the floodgates of emigration across the Mediterranean.
Well, they've also destroyed that. No, hang on. But they destroyed Libya in that process. It's now an absolute basket case. Maybe that's why he doesn't want to talk about it.
Well, that's why he didn't mention it. Of course, he did say that Libya is going to be a very successful country once they've cleaned the bodies off the beaches. Typical of Bojo Johnson, never heard a shot fired in anger, going on about what goes on in warfare. But anyway, what's now happening is the imperialist powers, France, Britain, the United States, are now actually starting to fall out. And the French are particularly annoyed because they're not being consulted about any of this. And of course, we in Britain have got to ask ourselves the question, we haven't got any decent dental care. Why are we trying to provoke a war with China on the other side of the world? Surely we've got better things to spend our money on, especially with all these shortages and such like. But of course, the whole mentality of the British ruling class has always been that we are a world power. And in fact, we withdrew from west of Suez in 1967 when Harold Wilson withdrew British forces from Aden. But we've got British forces back in what was Aden now fighting the locals. And we intend to go to the Southeast Asian. We've just withdrawn from Afghanistan and we're going to go to Southeast Asia to pick a fight with the Chinese. I would suggest that we've got better things to do with our money right here in these islands.
Yeah, you're right. And those fights may have worked 300-400 years ago, but not now. Anyway, on this, it'd be good to get your comments once you've heard from, we're going to hear now from Manfred Petrisch, who sadly died just a few weeks ago in his 70s, a fantastic commentator. His blog, All Smoke and Mirrors, was, really, really brilliant stuff. He was a former Swiss banker, is one of the only people of that ilk that ever ventured into the world of political commentator, and he did a superb job of it. You know, I always remember him talking about HS2 saying for £111 billion, which was the latest cost quote that came out when I spoke to him, you could build a railway around the world. And he was saying that as someone that has spent much of his life financing railway projects and similar sorts of big infrastructure projects from his job in Switzerland. But anyway, here he is talking, and we're good to hear what your take on his take, I suppose, on the whole situation with the Russians in the Middle East and Ukraine, etc. This is Manfred Petrisch, rest in peace. The last clip over the last few weeks, we've been playing some old clips, and this one I think we recorded back in April this year on Ukraine and Russia.
The Russians say, we don't want a war, but if you want one, you will get it, and we will just destroy you. I mean, the foreign minister of Russia said, if the Ukrainians think that they can attack, we will destroy Ukraine. And the same applies for the whole of Europe. all the American military bases in Europe will be number one target. There will be rockets flying into them and destroying them.
Well, they've got quite a few of those, in particularly in East Anglia, but there's quite a few in the UK.
Well, in Germany, there are 50 of them. And a lot of headquarters, like CENTCOM in Stuttgart and in Wiesbaden, they are the headquarters where all the wars are being managed. They will be the number one target. And also the storage of the atomic bombs in Germany. They will be hit first. It's obvious. Putin has warned the West. If you now cross the next red line, we will punish you, that you will regret forever. That's his actual words.
Yeah, but can he really do that?
Absolutely. The West does not realize what kind of a military the Russians have and what weapons they have. And they have learned a lot in the Syria war now. And you see how effective the weapons are there. I mean, a lot of Western military were totally surprised how effective the Russian weapons are. That's why they are selling like crazy their weapons everywhere. Everybody wants to buy their anti-aircraft missiles and their tanks and everywhere. And America has to, like Turkey, for instance, and then the Americans have to threaten Turkey not to buy the Russian equipment.
Well, I mean, this sounds to me like propaganda, really, because surely there's no reason why the Russian weaponry should be any better than the American weaponry. It's all, it's an arms race been going on for decades.
No, it's the Russian weaponry is much better because it is, you see, Russia has specialized in an asymmetric warfare. The Americans, they built for $3 billion an aircraft carrier. And the Russians, with a rocket of $1 million, can just sink it. Bang, it's gone. That's what you call asymmetry. With small weapons, you can destroy the big stuff of America. You see, aircraft carriers, where the last time aircraft carriers were any good was in the Second World War in the Pacific. In today's world, aircraft carriers are just huge coffins with 3,000 people on board. They are just floating coffins.
Now, one major flashpoint might be the Middle East between Israel and Iran. Do you see anything happening there?
What they are trying to do, like they always do, is also here, by provoking a conflict, they want America to then jump in and fight the war for Israel. You say Israel cannot attack Iran. What they will do, they do provocations, hoping that the Americans will then do the war, like they have done for against Iraq and Syria and Libya, right? And by the way, the Syrians were able to send a rocket yesterday from Syria to the atomic research place where the Israelis built the atomic bombs. And today the Israelis said they're all upset because the air defense did not work against the Syria rocket. There was no response from the Israeli air defense. So they're really upset. That means that the Russian weapons are able to go through the American air defenses. The rocket landed near Dimona, where the bomb factory is of the Israelis.
So I guess that was a threat.
Absolutely. The Syrians are saying, stop bombing our country, because we can do the same with you.
So that's Manfred Petrich there. Rest in peace, Manfred. His blog, All Smoke and Mirrors, was absolutely unmissable. And in fact, the guys, Vitali and the rest, make sure that blog stays there. And they're going to be continuing some of his research as well, because they used to go around digging up all sorts of information. We heard recently from them, a clip from them last week, and There's a longer interview on our show page at thisweek.org.uk if you're interested in some of the people that were helping Manfred, the former Swiss banker, Swiss German, to do his blog. And yeah, it's very sad to see him go. But we've been promised updates from Vitaly in the future. So we'll see how we go with that. But Martin, what do you make of the analysis? That's the key point here, isn't it?
Well, I broadly agree with all of that. I think a thing he didn't pick up on, which I will stress, is that the Russian military industries are owned by the state. And this means that they're able to keep costs down to an absolute minimum. They spend about 10% of what the US spends on military expenditure, but they make sure that every ruble counts. Not least because if it's run by the state, there's no profit to be made out of it. And they've got to be, you know, if they spend money on tanks, then they won't have money for hospitals. Whereas, of course, in the West, a huge kind of cancerous growth of private military industry has grown up. One of the things about this AUKUS deal, for example, is that Filton here in Bristol could end up producing the nuclear engines for these submarines. And that will be money in the pockets of British Aerospace and Rolls-Royce. But it will ultimately be taxpayer money thrown down the drain, because ultimately the Australians having a few nuclear submarines does nothing. All it does is antagonise the Chinese without doing anything to threaten them. And of course, from the Australian point of view, this is really stupid, because their main trading partner is, in fact, Australia. And the Chinese way to retaliate will be quite straightforward. It's already happening. They won't buy their stuff. And the fact the Chinese are really cheeky, they're buying the stuff from the Americans. Australia has had a pro-US dominated government since the overthrow of Gough Whitlam's Labour government in 1975, which tried to pursue an independent policy in relation to the US, pretty similar to what happened to Harold Wilson here. And the idea that either Australia or Britain is an independent country is a laugh, although New Zealand, of course, are carving out a different path.
Well, we're going to forego our musical break this week because we've got a shortened show. I've got to go and speak just after 7 o'clock at this annual general meeting of the Skolt, Head and District Common Right Holders Association here in Norfolk, where I'm coming to you live from at the moment, and a place called Overy, it just near... what's it called exactly? What is my this village I'm in? Oh gosh, I'm pretty sure it's Burnham Overy, and it's near Brancaster. I'm at Burnham Overy Village Hall at the moment, just sitting out the back here in the garden, waiting for Stephen Bocking, who says he'll be here in about 15-20 minutes, who's one of the common rights holders. So we'll be having a quick live chat with him. But we're going to plunge straight into looking at the pandemic now with a clip from Bill Gates, who is looking forward to the next pandemic, according to the Financial Times documentary.
The outbreak of COVID-19 brought China and then Europe to a standstill. As the novel coronavirus spread to the US and across the globe, it wasn't long before governments were betting billions of dollars on developing vaccines to fight the pandemic. A new vaccine market was about to emerge, where demand was unlimited, and governments would do everything in their power to secure doses.
The total amounts involved relative to normal vaccine R&D, you know, it's tens of billions of dollars, maybe a total of, you know, $25 billion or so. That's gigantic in the world of vaccines. Now, relative to the economic damage of the pandemic, which is in the trillions, it's truly a rounding error. This is the best money that's been spent by governments during this pandemic.
The public sector, governments collectively, have really de-risked and subsidized the R&D process every step of the way, from the earliest stages of R&D, oftentimes to the scale-up of manufacturing and, of course, purchasing.
You know, I do think for the next pandemic, we will be able to solve the problems of the mRNA platform. That is, we'll fix the thermostability, we'll fix the scalability, and we'll fix the cost. We kind of caught mRNA halfway to prime time. Vaccines probably save more lives than any other tool. If we can take vaccines and apply them more in the area of cancer, then that just changes the numbers completely, because the cancer market, you know, is It's, you know, over 10 times the R&D, over 10 times the spend, you know, potential for growth. I'm very enthused that vaccines, all the standby capacity that we will have on for the next pandemic, we may be able to use that when there's not a pandemic going on to create lots of low-cost supply capacity for the entire world. And, you know, imagine that you'd had a vaccine, you know, back in the summer, you would have saved millions of lives.
COVID-19 has already changed the vaccine market, potentially irreversibly.
So that's an excerpt from the documentary. It's called The Financial Times. It's called The Next Pandemic, The Financial Times documentary. This whole idea of de-risk and subsidize, Martin. I mean, Bill Gates is obsessed by vaccines. He wants everybody in the world to have as many vaccines as possible. He wants to channel as much public money into vaccines as possible. It's a little bit like his previous obsession with getting Trojan horses and backdoors into everyone's computer.
Yeah. I mean, the way they talk about the vaccine market is very clear, isn't it? It's a market. It's about money. And of course, it's a very interesting market because the R&D for the AstraZeneca vaccine and the Pfizer vaccine, all the rest of it, is actually funded by the public sector. But the profits made when you've created the vaccines are taken by private sector actors like Pfizer. And this is what the mainstream is concerned about, although nothing is being done about it, leaving aside the wider questions of, you know, what is COVID, where did it come from, etc., etc. And, you know, these people are incorrigible. There's no doubt about it. The idea that what we need is more of this. I mean, what is Gates' actual qualification to speak about vaccines? He's supposedly a software engineer, financial person. Now, you know, it doesn't mean he can't have opinions about other things, but why are we listening to him about something?
Well, I mean, you know, the media
is not his topic at all.
Well, the mass media put him out as basically Dr. Gates, don't they?
Well, they do indeed. And of course, he's, but I think that there's a bit too much emphasis upon him as an individual and not enough on what is wrong with the way medical. Care is organized in capitalist societies like the US. It's a shambles. It's a profit making shambles in which health gets very, you know, real health is very much down the list of things. Why should the United States lecture anybody in the world about how to manage healthcare?
I see it really.
The most ridiculously overexpensive and ineffective healthcare systems on the planet.
In fact, what I see it as is undoubtedly the worst
waste of money on the planet.
What I see it as is an acquisition of the mass media, which is supposed to be questioning and journalistic, as a kind of advertising platform, really, for Mr. Gates and his vaccines. But anyway, we're going to hear now a longer clip. This is 12 minutes or so from Doctor of the Week. His name is Dr. Michael McDowell. He is from the Caribbean, and here he is talking about the bioweapons industry and also what he calls the six smoking guns of SARS-CoV-2.
When I did A-level biology under Father Gerard Farfan at Fatima College, we used a textbook called Biology, a Functional Approach by MBV Roberts. And we learned then that form and function should be one, that form follows function. In fact, the purpose of design is function. And I want to start my presentation by looking at a quick backdrop of the genetic bioweapons industry. And I think the world first became aware of the fact that there was such a bioweapons industry when a gentleman by the name of Dr. Leonard Horowitz published a book called Emerging Viruses in 1996. Emerging Viruses, AIDS and Ebola, Natural or Intentional. That was the title of the book. And in this academic treatise, and he's a virologist and a vaccinologist, he proved that AIDS and Ebola are manufactured viruses, engineered in a laboratory. His academic treatise has stood the test of time. It has never been refuted. Wow. And we know that the way academics stand and fall is on being presented and refuted. This has never been refuted. And the genetic bioweapons industry is the most covert industry on planet Earth, but it exists. I would like to go further by saying that William Cohen, the former U.S. Secretary of State in 1997, Cohen referred to the concept of an ethnic bioweapon as a possible risk. In 1998, some biological weapon experts considered such a genetic weapon plausible. And you know, when they say that, it means they've already produced it and they're stockpiling it and waiting to use it. And that research was being done on how certain substances can influence human genes. That was 1998. 10 years later, in 2008, the U.S. Government Congressional Committee sat under the label Genetics and Other Human Modification Technologies. A new kind of arms race, people, a new kind of arms race is happening. Yes. And somebody, in that committee said, there are attempts to manipulate human genetics in ways that would horrify us. And so that was 2008. Let me go a little further and go beyond William Cohen. And we want to introduce you to somebody called Dr. Francis Boyle. Very, very significant gentleman. I think we have a photo of Dr. Boyle that we could put up. Dr. Francis Boyle is an international law expert. He's also an expert on genetic bioweapons. And he was a gentleman who framed the Anti-Terrorism Act. It's called the Bioweapons Anti-Terrorism Act, or BWATA. It was framed in 1989, signed into law in 1990 by President George W. Bush, with unanimous approval from the U.S. Senate and the U.S. Congress. And so if there is a Genetic Bioweapons Anti-Terrorism Act, it means, obviously, there must be a genetic bioweapons industry. And I want you to know, people, that on this Earth, 22 nations on planet Earth have what we call BSL-4 labs. A BSL-4 lab means biosafety level 4. Biosafety level 4 is the highest level of biosafety. And in these labs, they make pathogens, deadly pathogens. I also want you to know that 16 nations on planet Earth stockpile genetic bioweapons. 16 nations stockpile. They have them in their armory. There's a new arms race going on. And I want to give you a quote from Dr. Francis Boyle. Dr. Francis Boyle, the framer of the Anti-Terrorism Act, says this, international law expert, bioweapons expert, SARS-CoV-2 is an offensive biological warfare agent made in a lab and engineered with gain-of-function properties. He said that in February 2020. I have quoted this in a documentary I did. It's on YouTube called Watchmen, What of the Night, Part 1, where I spelled this out very clearly. And he has come to the conclusion, and this is going to shock you, amen, put on your seatbelts, this is going to shock you. He has come to the conclusion that SARS-CoV-2 is a tripartite chimera. And it is composed of one, SARS, the original SARS, and he says SARS is already weaponized. And then that SARS virus was enhanced by gain-of-function properties. And step three, they were all then genetically recombined with an HIV virus. That's the virus that causes AIDS. So a tripartite chimera. If you think I am kidding, I have some notes here that I could refer to. And I call them smoking gun 1, 2, and 3. Francis Boyle, quoting from an article called Antiviral Research, February 10, 2020, written by 3 French scientists and 1 Canadian scientist from Montreal, said the Wuhan coronavirus genetic analysis may provide a gain of function to 2019 novel coronavirus. The Wuhan coronavirus genetic analysis may provide a gain of function to 2019 novel coronavirus for efficient spreading in human population compared to other beta coronaviruses. He says that is a smoking gun. It was genetically engineered for efficient spreading in human population. Wow. That's recorded. Gain of function, if you don't know what gain of function means, gain of function means genetically engineered to be more lethal, more virulent, more infectious, and to mutate or adapt more readily with slight increases in immune selection pressure from the population. It's also called accelerated viral evolution. And I saw Dr. Gill refer to that in his campaign about, and he used the colloquial parlance, just so. Viruses don't just so jump from animal to human. Smoking gun number 2, UNC, and that's the University of North Carolina, don't be surprised. The University of North Carolina labs at Chapel Hill brought a team together to do an experiment And part of the North Carolina University team was, they were joined by a gentleman from China called Dr. Zheng Li Shi. Dr. Zheng Li Shi. He was from the Wuhan Institute of Virology and the Chinese Academy of Sciences. And in fact, Wuhan gave a grant to the University of North Carolina so that scientists could be involved in this experiment. They imported SARS cells, SARS viruses, from the Fort Detrick labs. And for those of you who know geopolitics and covert geopolitics, very necessary for any Bible prophecy teacher or any pastor in this day to know, amen, Fort Detrick, the Fort Detrick labs are the US's main BSL-4 labs where they research, stockpile, and test genetic bioweapons. And so this team, given a grant by China, were working on increasing the pathogenicity of the SARS samples that they got from Fort Detrick. Smoking gun number three, research at the Australian Animal Health Lab was funded by the Chinese Ministry of Science and Technology, along with the other two I mentioned, the Wuhan Institute and the Academy of Sciences from China. And the experimental goal was to coalesce the initial weaponized SARS virus, enhance it with gain-of-function properties, and then coalesce it genetically to an HIV virus, amen, therefore forming the tripartite chimera. And so I'm listening to you where these experiments took place. Let me go a little further. Smoking gun number four. Indian scientists did an analysis on the SARS-CoV-2 virus, and they said they definitely found elements of the HIV virus in the genomic sequencing. So this was confirmed by a team from India. And let me mention to you that HIV is a retrovirus. Retroviruses use mRNA to inject their stuff into the cell. And when the mRNA is injected into the cell, there is something called retrointegration that takes place. And that means that the mRNA is converted back into DNA, and then it coalesces with the chromosomal DNA of the host. So retroviruses like HIV carry an enzyme called reverse transcriptase, which changes mRNA back into DNA so it can coalesce with the genes in your nucleus. This means that when they said it's an mRNA vaccine, and they said it will only go to the ribosomes and form proteins, that's not true. I mean, it will be reconverted to DNA and affect your human genome. Wow. So Francis Boyle says this, the most dangerous biological weapon ever released on the public is SARS-CoV-2. Wow. Now, let me go to smoking gun, which number five? Smoking gun five? Smoking gun number five, Fauci's emails. Fauci's emails say this. Well, first of all, we must note Fauci's vacillations. When he was called, when recently he was called to testify to the U.S. Congressional Committee, and this is all on video record, he said no, U.S. taxpayers did not fund the Wuhan laboratory. Then he said yes, U.S. taxpayers did fund the laboratory, but it was a subgrant. Then he said we funded it, but there was no gain-of-function research. Then he said we did fund it, there was gain-of-function research, but it was a sound scientific decision. Jeez. Then he said it would have been negligent not to fund it. So he kept vacillating back and forth, and I said this is all on record. Let me go further to another one of Fauci's emails. This is from Dr. Christian Anderson, and I'm proving to you that SARS is, that SARS-CoV-2 is a genetic bioweapon. Dr. Christian Anderson, in an email, a secret email that was unearthed when Fauci's emails were exposed, he said the unusual features of the virus make up a really small part of the genome. So no one has to look, one has to look really closely at the sequence to see that some features look engineered.
Wow.
Smoking gun number six. Further, this is the same guy, Dr. Christian Anderson, writing in an email to Dr. Fauci. Further, I should mention that after discussions with Eddie, Bob, and Mike, his fellow virologists, we all find the genome inconsistent with expectations from evolutionary theory. This is what Dr. Gill was referring to. The way a virus normally evolves, this virus didn't look like that. So they found, number one, the virus looked engineered, and it looked inconsistent with evolutionary theory. Wow. So, beloved, this states very clearly that that SARS-CoV-2 is a genetic bioweapon. And let's go to Charles Leiber. Charles Leiber was the is the head of biology and the head of chemical biology at Harvard University. He was. And this guy used to train graduate Chinese students. Yes, that's him up on the screen. Used to train graduate Chinese students in his lab. He's a microbiologist of the highest note, and he has received over $15 million in defense contracts from the United States government to do just that, create genetic bioweapons. Two of his students were arrested at the Logan International Airport in December 2019, smuggling 21 vials of sensitive biological material to Wuhan, China. Amen. Charles Leiber himself was arrested by the FBI on January 28, 2020 for espionage with China. He was their consultant and actually was a hands-on builder of the BSL-4 lab in Wuhan, China. China has won the Luke's BSL-4 lab. It was built by Charles Leiber through his consultancy. He was paid $150 million to do that and had a salary of $50,000 a month from China. Amen. And so it has become very clear that SARS-CoV-2 is not a Kung Fu virus or a Chinese virus, as some people say. It was due to Anglo-Asian complicity. Amen. Leiber's involvement actually goes much deeper than I mentioned in, but that's not for this paper. I will skip at this point. I have talked extensively about vaccine types and mass vaccination at the time of a pandemic. But I'm just going to hit on one thing quickly before I go to my final point. Yes, I want you to understand that the vaccine types that are on the market, Pfizer, Moderna, AstraZeneca, and Johnson & Johnson, are all genetic vaccines. They are mRNA and viral vector vaccines that will affect your human genome. They are not normal. Amen. The normal vaccines that I got when I was a child and my children got when I was an adult, amen, are attenuated or inactivated virus vaccines. And these vaccines are new technology, never before been deployed in the human population. They are tools of gene therapy or Frankenstein technology, as some people call it, amen, a mystery concoction. Amen. And they are not normal. Therefore, and I hear doctors on television conflating the two types of vaccines. They are tools of gene therapy. If SARS-CoV-2 is a bioweapon, then the code of the spike protein for SARS-CoV-2 injected into you, you're having a bioweapon injected into you. And the spike protein, I won't go into the scientific details right now, but the spike protein is pathogenic and it will damage you. Dr. Sukrit Bagdi says the vaccine is a thrombogenic vaccine. And he warns of neural venous thrombosis, and he warns of the decimation of the human population.
Well, that's pretty shocking, if true. But I mean, you know, this, here we go. Dr. Michael McDowell, and the contrast, of course, is with non-Dr. Bill Gates. Bill Gates seems to get a massive amount of TV coverage all around the world, radio coverage, newspaper coverage. You know, being the richest or second richest man in the world does help, obviously, but he's not a doctor. There's a doctor giving a completely different point of view. Martin, I wonder what you make of that and the all the various contentions there about, you know, what he's saying is there's six smoking guns at least of the SARS-CoV-2. He, for one, is convinced that it's a bioweapon.
Well, that's what I've concluded from my own limited research. And, of course, a lot of the arguments have been about the vaccines rather than the virus itself. Now, the question is, if it's a biological weapon, who developed it and to what end? And of course, what you've got on the right wing in the US and Australia is this idea that the Chinese were covertly developing these bioweapons and they leaked from their laboratory. But then it turns out that the laboratory was actually funded by DARPA, which is the Pentagon.
Well, this is why this whole China stuff. The China stuff is not going to stick, is it?
In the US.
The China stuff is not going to stick, is it?
Well, I think we're getting this. This is where medical science ends and military intelligence analysis begins. I do not think it is at all credible that the Chinese would deliberately have tried to infect their own population with something that they were developing as a bioweapon. It's logically possible that they may have done it by accident. But I think by far the most likely explanation here, given what we know about NATO intelligence services and 9/11 and all the rest of it, is that this was a deliberate biological warfare attack on China with the vaccines put out by Big Pharma in the West as a second tap strike. But well, of course, yeah, what about, there are vaccines what out there said, Martin, which are not
sorry,
produced
we are pushed for time.
By Western
we're big
pharma.
Pushed, Martin,
the Russians,
we're pushed for time.
The Chinese and the Cubans have all developed their own vaccines.
Yeah, Martin, we are pushed for time. Martin, we're pushed for time, so appreciate it if you can keep your answers quite short. The fact is, though, that there is, I mean, what exactly what McDowell is saying there is that the actual poison, the toxin, could be far more actually the vaccine than it is the COVID itself.
Well, it could be in both, Tony, couldn't it?
Yeah, it could. All right. Anyway, so we're going to hear wrap up in a few minutes with what I found was a fascinating interview with Rachel Elanau. I'm not sure quite how to pronounce that. Elanaugh. And she is somebody who was on the TV program, which is all about trying to make money, called Dragon's Den. She made some money. I mean, I'm not even sure what business she was in, but she has come out with, I think, some fascinating research on the timing of the various COVID measures. We'll be hearing that just before the end of the show. But I'm joined right now by one of the common rights holders from here in Skolt Head, around Skolt Head area of North Norfolk. And his name's Stephen Bocking. He's also on the parish council. Now, last time I heard from you and last time I spoke to you, Stephen, which was about 4 weeks ago, you were still a fully fledged member of the parish council. Now, I understand you had a little bit of ticking off by the chair of your very own parish council to which you were elected in Brancaster.
Yes, we did. We had a vote of no confidence against me and a fellow common right holder. It went to a vote, and the members of the golf club, which now holds the majority on the parish council, all voted against us, and we were censured for telling the truth, basically. But and that's as far as it can go. They can't get us off the parish council, so apart from causing a lot of contention, it's done no good whatsoever.
Okay, so they've sort of, I suppose it's slap wrist, but are you been told that you've got to come off of some other committees which the parish council go on to?
Yes, we were taken off, me personally was taken off the Smith's Trust, which has been gone for 400 or 500 odd years. And, you know,
so what do they do?
They're a local charity, look after the almshouses and a farm which supplies the money. They also was set up originally to support the poor children of the village, you know, for books and things like that. And the other one, which is a contentious one, is Barrow Common, which we're still wanting to see what's going to happen with that one.
Well, look, Bryony Bax, she's the chairman of the parish council. Her husband is actually quite a big newspaper magnate. And I understand that he was part of the Eastern Daily Press, which was owned by Archant. And there were some rather peculiar deals went on over the last couple of years. Now, these are massive regional newspaper empires that her husband has been chief executive of. What was the story about how the Eastern Daily Press and Archant came to financial difficulties and then the money suddenly popped up somewhere else?
Well, I mean, I only know what's on the computer. Obviously, you know, when all this went on with different matters, we looked into things, or I did, and we found that Archant got themselves into trouble and called in the receivers.
So hang on, this is quite a successful newspaper empire. What happened there?
I don't honestly know, but. I do know that they called in the receivers, and that was all. They had several companies, one of which was, I believe it was called Torbay Publishing. They ploughed a lot of money into that in 2020, and then in 2021, the Archant called in the receivers, and that was all sold off. And a gentleman who bought, or the company that bought Torbay Publishing, is a company which is run or part-owned or whatever by Mr. Bax, which I found very strange.
I mean, it's lots and lots of money. Some of the houses changing hands in Brancaster now for £800,000 a go. Now, this is not, this is, I suppose, a relatively recent thing in this part of the country, isn't it? That the houses have suddenly become incredibly valuable.
Well, yeah, that's all to do with sailing and everything. And the social standing of the area is another big thing. But, I mean, I personally haven't got no problem with all that. You know, they'll always be rich and they'll always be poor. But what I have a great problem with is not the privilege, it's the abuse of privilege, which I have a problem with. And I must admit that since meeting Tony, that's made me a lot more militant than what I was before.
Oh dear, well, Martin Summers and I did the same with a lot of the Asian community and the Muslim community when it were over 7-7, because we'd dug up a lot of evidence that actually it was many of the Western powers that may have actually been behind the 7-7 London bombings. And we were told by the BBC the producer that did the program on 7-7, the Conspiracy Files program, Tristan was it Quinn? I'm not sure his second name. Anyway, we were made to look very, very dangerous. Now, I don't know. I mean, I don't particularly want to be dangerous in this part of the country, but I do want to see the right thing done by people like yourself, Stephen. And we'll see what happens over the next few months and years as to whether these... Because what we've got effectively is we've got a kind of good cop, bad cop opposition to the common rights holders in Skulthead, which is... The bad cop, the people that are always out trying to make the money, issue the legal threats, things like that. This is the Royal West Norfolk Golf Club. But the good cop in the background that try and be friendly and nice and extremely kind to everybody, but actually are sneakily putting in these claims to those common lands is the National Trust. Now, I think for most people, they think, Stephen, the National Trust is there to take donations of land, not to take land.
Well, I don't really know too much about that, Tony. But one thing I would like to say is getting back to the golf club. I mean, they're not all bad people in the golf club. I can assure you of that. There's some proper people in there, real people. But that's just one or two seem to, I don't know how to describe it really, but there's things going on that shouldn't be going on. And some of the older members, I don't think, appreciate all this publicity. And stuff, and for what? For money, for, you know, just sheer greed at the end of the day. I mean, we don't particularly want the golf club to fold, but I do think that the village, the parish of Brancaster should have a fair go. And at present, nobody's getting a fair go, and I don't think it's right.
Well, that's right. I mean, for example, the car park, which is disputed ownership, is raking in the cash, isn't it? And it would be nice to see some of that actually going to the parish of Brancaster.
Well, I totally agree. The parish have been having a share or a split, whatever they like to call it, for several years, well, since it was originally set up. But there's no money coming to the common right holders. All we want is some money to plow back in to protect in the common. That's all we're looking for. We're not looking for money for ourselves, as the rumor keeps going round and round and round. We're not looking for it. What we want is a fair go at a fair amount of money to be split within the parish.
Okay, well, that's Stephen Bocking there. Thanks very much, Stephen. And we'll be joining the annual general meeting. I'm looking for the Sky News truck and the BBC truck and ITV, ITN coming down here to cover this. But I shall be covering it. I'll be doing a report on next week's too. But we'll finish this evening with a clip which is from this woman called Rachel Elno about some of the lockdown measures. In fact, what we'll do, I think next week we'll use the... I've also got a bit of George Monbiot talking about stopping the grazing of the commons, which is rather surprising since he's supposed to be an environmental journalist on marginal land. So we'll have that next week. But we'll finish this week with what I thought was kind of devastating, very interesting look at... It's called Time and Space by Rachel Elnau, that's Elnaugh, and it looks at the UK occult COVID timeline. Fascinating.
Let's now look at the 8 points of the compass and map those onto time. Because obviously, if you think about the north and the south is where the sun is at its hottest. The north is where it's at its coldest. And if you map those 8 points of the compass, there are 360 degrees of the compass. There are 365 days in the year. So you can see the correlation between the points of the compass and the points on the calendar. So the north equates to the winter solstice, which is the Yule. The northeast relates to Imbolc, which is a pagan festival on around February 1st or 2nd. The date changes from year to year. Then you've got in the east, the equinox, the spring equinox called Ostara in the pagan calendar. And that's typically between 19th and 21st of March. Again, the date varies according to the year because of that slight difference between there's not 360 days in the year, there's 365. Then in the southeast, corresponding to that, you've got Beltane, which is the rising energy of the Beltane fire in May of the spring. You've got Litha, which is the summer solstice between June the 20th to 22nd, which is in the south, the peak of energy. You've got Lammas on 1st of August, which relates to the southwest. Mabon, which we're coming up to, the autumn equinox between September the 22nd to 24th, around about that date. And then Samhain, which is the northwest, which is Halloween. So all of these dates in the calendar have tremendous power, which is why in ancient times in the temples, they would do ceremonies on the solstices, on the equinoxes, and in the pagan calendar on those quarter point dates of Imbolc, Beltane, Lammas and Samhain. I know this sounds very witchy, but all of this speaks to the metaphysical power of time and space. So now let us look at the timeline of the COVID lockdowns. And this is a map of exactly what happened as everything unfolded last year. So you can see the first key date, 23rd of March in the spring equinox, the Prime Minister announces the first lockdown in the UK, ordering people to stay at home. Then you get to the summer solstice and the Prime Minister says the UK's national hibernation is coming to an end and he relaxes those restrictions. So this power is being exerted on these key dates, whether it's locking people down or saying, oh, you can come out of your houses now. Then look, 22nd September, last year, the Prime Minister announces new restrictions in England, including a return to working from home and a 10 p.m. curfew for the hospitality sector. It happened last autumn equinox. And then do you remember in the run up to Christmas last year, where they were basically saying, we're not going to cancel Christmas, we're not going to cancel Christmas, and then boom, 21st December, the winter solstice, tier four restrictions come into force in London and southeast England. There is no coincidence. These dates are power points. They are being used to assert power and influence over the people. And the people who are behind the dark forces, who are behind the COVID agenda, this is Masonic, and it is used for satanic purposes, because I do believe that in the beginning, the Masons and those who held the secrets of the mystery schools were using them for benevolent purposes, building temples, building churches. But at some stage in that process, and I suspect it was in the reign of Henry VIII, when he took power back from Rome into creating the Church of England, where he turned all of the monasteries into public schools. Those mystery school teachings were embedded into the public school education system.
Wow. Well, how I think fascinating. That is her name, Rachel Elnor. I mean, I'm not sure how to pronounce it. Sorry, Rachel, but it's E-L-N-A-U-G-H. Easiest way to say it is Rachel Elnor. Time and Space is that recording that she's done there. She's famous for telling Chris Whitty, the government scientific officer, that he's going to hang because of the vaccination of children. Well, that's an interesting thing to say on Twitter. And there's a very good reason why maybe that will happen, because of the breaking of the Nuremberg codes. And basically, Chris Whitty, by doing this fluoridation and by vaccinating kids with an unsafe vaccine, which hasn't been properly tested, which finishes testing in 2 years' time, which they're not vulnerable to COVID either. So you're vaccinating them against something which they're not vulnerable against. You can hear the geese going over head, over Hoover skull head. I think they're thinking about somewhere to spend the night. So that's good old Chris Whitty for us. Dr. Mengele of the British government. So what is he doing in that job? So that's all for tonight. And it's time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and sound engineer Dave Bazanko. Download our MP3s and you can listen in the car or anywhere you like. To be included on my weekly email circulation list, get hold of me at tony@cultureshop.org.uk. You'll find not the BCFM politics shows, podcast, story links, comment page, and our contact details. Do please send me interviews and story tips at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm shadow banned on Twitter at Tony Gosling. My book, after 30 years of research into the dodgiest ever deals done between the Allies and the Nazis in the last 8 months of World War II, the subsequent creation of the Bilderbergers and links back to the disastrous Battle of Arnhem, portrayed in the film A Bridge Too Far, is out in paperback, priced £15, including postage, on eBay. Also, my anthology on secret government from Cromwell to the assassination of Princess Diana is called The Siege of Heaven Reader. You can get either of them on eBay and the Siege of Heaven ebook, and all links to all of them via Bilderberg.org. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream, except when we're restreaming the Richie Allen show, and over Sunday lunch at CamberleysRadioQUK.com. Do please make live recordings. We've been streaming live from the town of Burnham Overy Staithe Village Hall in North Norfolk. That's where I've been talking to you from, the garden. This meeting's just about to start at 7 p.m. I think by some minor miracle we're almost finished a little, just about a minute early. Good God, that's the first time that's ever happened. Also, we've been streaming via the PRSC servers in Bristol and at RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. Censorship and self-censorship of life-saving information is sadly the norm in Britain today, thanks to the Nazi collaborators who own the transmitters and the printing presses. The glorious Fourth Reich, which we're 18 months into now, I would contest. So, if you can restream us live or rebroadcast, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.